Who can say where the killer roams, where the blood flows, it's slaying time. Slay away, slay away, slay away.
Hey Slayers, welcome back to Slay Away. I'm Enola Lagosi and I'm here to chat about lore, gore, true crime, and every kill in between while I discuss horror films with special guests every other Friday night. On this episode, we'll be talking about all things Leatherface and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre with returning guest Donnie Goodman. Donnie is the author of horror anthology The Razor Blades in My Head and the creator of Bookstagram and YouTube channel The Horror Hypothesis. So everyone should go follow right now. Thanks. Welcome back to the podcast, Donnie.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
It's a really big one. It's going to be very meaty. And I put a signal out into the social media void and Donnie answered. So I appreciate you coming by. And, are you ready to discuss the Texas Chainsaw Massacre with me?
I am absolutely ready. And I really appreciate the pun, the meaty pun there. That was great.
Do you have like one word to review TCM with?
My one word review for this film would probably be, let's see. I would go with, I already called it classic, and that's like just what really just pops out when I think of this film. I'd call it barometer. That would be my one barometer. Word review. Yeah, barometer. It's the barometer.
Yeah. I asked my dad this same question earlier today. I said, hey, have you ever seen the Texas Chainsaw Massacre? He says, yeah, I saw it in 1974 when it came out. I said, okay, well, what did you think? Like, what's your, give me your one word review. He said, he looked at me, his eyes got really wide and he said, scary. Like, it was scary. That was his first reaction. I said, that was your initial reaction to the film when you saw it in 1974. I was like, great. Okay, there you go. It's scary. And barometer.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that because I actually had lunch with my dad today and same exact thing. Like, I brought it up. I said, oh, like when he was like, oh, what are you doing later today? I was like, oh, I'm going to do a podcast on Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And of course, he just rolled it out his eyes because he's not like a horror. I do not get my love of horror from my parents. It's just that's something completely independent. But he did bring up the same thing. Like he remembers seeing Texas Chainsaw Massacre when it actually came out in 1974. So yeah, but it may not be quite as good as just scary, but yeah, I'm going to stick with barometer.
His eyes got so wide and I was like, okay, my dad's like, he's super into the atomic age of horror, like
yeah.
Them and The Thing or he likes the Thing from Another World. He also remake, but all that kind of stuff, so.
Well, that's what's so amazing about when I think about this film specifically is just I've told people many times over the years that if I could go back in time and watch any film like when it came out before I was born, but before I was old enough to go to the movie theater, this 100% would be the film that I would want to see just to be a fly on the wall watching people experience this movie for the first time, because this is so far from that atomic age horror film and golden age horror films of like the Universal monsters. Like I just cannot imagine how shocked audiences were. They talk about how shocked people were when they saw Hitchcock's films, and it's just like Psycho and this. I mean, come on. Like it is
shocked
this
enough
is...
for this film to get banned. That's that's how shocked I Well, let's jump into just like a quick summary of the film. For those who don't know, when Sally Hardesty, I don't know why Hooper picked like the hardest name ever to say. hears that her grandfather's grave may have been vandalized, she and her paraplegic brother Franklin set out with their friends to investigate. After a detour to their family's old farmhouse, they discover a group of crazed, murderous outcasts living next door. As the group is attacked one by one by the chainsaw-wielding Leatherface, who wears a mask of human skin, the survivors must do everything they can to escape. It is at this time you should stop what you're doing, stop listening to this podcast. And if you haven't seen the film that we're talking about today, please go watch the film, come back, and then continue on this journey with us because we want you to enjoy it right along with us. Now, let's get back to the film. The film's directed by Tobe Hooper. So everyone should know Tobe Hooper by now. If you listened to our episode on Poltergeist, the concept for the Texas Chainsaw Massacre came about in the early 1970s while Hooper was working as an assistant film director at the University of Texas at Austin. Funny enough, I'm moving to Austin on October 1st when this is coming out. So he had already developed a story involving a lot of the elements of isolation and the woods and darkness, and he credited the graphic violence of San Antonio news outlets at the time as one of the inspirations for the film and based elements of the plot around serial killer Ed Gein in the 1950s. Gein was a murderer in Wisconsin. It's kind of like, I gotta say, like, serial killer is a strong word for Gein. He also inspired other horror films such as Psycho and Silence of the Lambs. And during development, Hooper actually used like the working title Head Cheese and Leatherface. I don't know what the head cheese thing is a reference to.
It's the when they're talking about when the hitchhiker the van, he brings up the process of making head cheese.
I totally forgot about that.
And Franklin mentions that he has had it before. Everyone else is staring in horror.
There's this other thing in the film where Franklin is just like has a sausage or something just hanging out of his mouth, and it's really weird. I'm just like, okay, Franklin, I can't handle you. Franklin's a very obnoxious character, but anyway, the character of Leatherface, the lead antagonist in the film, like we said, is loosely based on the real life of convicted murderer and body snatcher Ed Gein. So I think Gein maybe killed two people, but he mostly robbed graves. And he's also known as the grandfather of gore, the ghoul of Plainfield, the Plainfield butcher, or the Plainfield ghoul. Just like Gene, the character of Leatherface skins his victims, creates suits, furniture, and his iconic human skin mask. So I love finding where horror has a basis in reality or true crime. Now go and research Ed Gein if you don't know who that is and you're also obsessed with true crime. The other thing is that not only the films Psycho and Silence of the Lambs have this sort of basis, it's really the characters of Norman Bates and Buffalo Bill in those films. So I highly encourage people to dig in and research it a little bit. Yeah, it's kind of, it's a little wild because there's actually a lot more that goes into it than just the Ed Gein influence. There's actually an instance where Hooper, I guess, he was at a shopping mall like during the holidays, and originally he was going to do like a modern retelling of Hansel and Gretel, and then kind of combine these elements of Ed Gein's story. But according to him, he had this like light bulb moment that ignited the film kind of while he was at a department store during the Christmas rush in 1972. And he's quoted as saying, "There were these big Christmas crowds. I was frustrated and I found myself near a display rack of chainsaws. I just kind of zoned in on it." And he had told the Texas Monthly that he just focused in on the rack of chainsaws. And he thought, "I know a way I could get through this crowd really quickly." With the channels. He says, "I went home, sat down, all the channels just tuned in, the zeitgeist blew through, and the whole damn story came to me in what seemed like about 30 seconds. And the hitchhiker, the older brother at the gas station, the girl escaping twice, the dinner sequence, people out in the country, like out of gas, like the whole thing." So I just thought that was so interesting. And yeah, I never go shopping during the holidays because
of course
it's going to make you want to kill someone. Let's dig in a little bit to some of the notes on the release of the film, because upon its release, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre was banned in several countries. Numerous theaters stopped showing the film in response to complaints about the violence, and it led to this big franchise that continued the story of Leatherface and his family through eight sequels, prequels, and a remake. And then there's also comic books and video games. There's so much stuff. So definitely an iconic character throughout time, but we can dig in a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting. I mean, obviously Leatherface is the standout iconic antagonist from this film, but just the whole family, I don't know. It's interesting to me how Leatherface became the character that lived on through so many of the sequels, because I don't know, just the dad, the grandpa, and then, you know, going into the sequels, like, you know, the part two, I know we're focusing on part one, but like, there's just, I don't know, there's so many like iconic characters from this this franchise that, you know, while I understand why Leatherface becomes the default kind of face of the franchise, it really is a family centered film.
Yeah, it definitely is. And it's not only Leatherface's family, but like Sally, her family, like the only family she has left, right?
Yeah, right.
At the time. So her family and her friends. And I always, through the years, I felt that maybe Leatherface is a bit of a misunderstood character, because when you think about it, and I know we haven't gotten into talking too much about the film yet, but when you think about it, these people just showed up, walked into this person's house in Texas, of all places. And technically, he would have been justified to stand his ground.
No, and yeah, in 2021, nothing would have happened.
No, you know, this wouldn't have been like, it's a cautionary tale of like, hey, yeah, don't just walk into somebody's house. But yeah, technically, they were trespassing. And he didn't go hunt anyone down that didn't actually come to the house themselves, I think, except maybe Franklin and Sally in the woods. So but just talking about the cast really quick, because it seems like there's a big cast, but it's really not that many people. So like, just to focus in on the key people, Marilyn Burns plays Sally, Alan Danziger plays Jerry, Paul A. Partain plays Franklin, William Vale plays Kirk, Terry McMinn plays Pam, and Edwin Neal plays the hitchhiker. Jim Sadow plays the old man. That's so creepy. Gunnar Hansen plays Leatherface, and John Dugan plays the grandfather. But yeah, it's kind of interesting. Hooper had cited there were a lot of changes in the cultural and political landscape as central influences on the film, and he sort of had a lot of intentional misinformation that the film you're about to see is true, right? They're based on true events. Not exactly. Yes, the character of Leatherface is inspired by Ed Gein, but these events did not happen. But he was influenced by the news media at the time.
Yeah, that the intro sequence of this is like easily one of my favorite parts about the film. The John Larroquette doing the opening narration, it's so much better. I don't watch this film as much as I return to like some of my other favorites, but I probably watch it usually once per spooky season for sure. Like it's always in my rotation for Halloween. And I always forget how it just sets the tone right off the bat with that disturbing crawl. And it's so beyond, like in my brain, I always remember it as just like what you're about to see is true, but it's so much worse than that. It's like a, you know, there's so many films that have kind of taken this and run with it as far as like just throwing, oh, what you're about to see is based on true events, even though it's just a completely fictionalized story. But this one, I'm trying to see if I can find the actual quote. Just it's got so many good lines. For them, an idyllic summer, a summer afternoon drive became a nightmare. Just this line right here. But had they lived very, very long lives, they could not have expected, nor would they have wished to see as much of the mad and macabre as they were to see that day. Like that is all they needed to say was the film, what you're about to see is based on a true story, but they had to go in there and just really dive in and just kind of prep the viewer for something that when you go from that crawl to that iconic first shot of the, you know, the camera exposure sounds, and then the sculpture. It's just like unbelievably disturbing. So I love the opening to this.
It's very, very spooky, like extremely spooky. And with that whole misinformation thing, he intentionally had said, like we talked about, the film you are about to see is true. And it was a response to being lied to by the government. There was a lot going on that influenced Hooper for this, but those are some really amazing opening lines that really set the tone of like, just get ready for shit to get weird, like in the best way possible. Most of the cast was fairly unknown, which I think that was pretty common at the time. Like before we got into the 80s film, where 80s films where it was all unknown actors and slashers and things like that. I think this was this a big like influencer.
It's like a student film, you know. It's like this thing is like that's what it equates to, is a student film. So even for the time, it's massively low budget, and I mean, I think it was shot for less than $200,000. So it's extremely low budget for the era. So,
well, filming primarily happened at this like 1900s farmhouse that's located on Quick Hill Road near Road Rock, Texas. And there was a new development going up at the time, but it was a very small budget, and there were a lot of concerns about going over cost. So, a lot of different things happening. They were like working 7 days a week, up to 16 hours a day. It was really hot and humid. It was like 110 degrees Fahrenheit, apparently. And I guess Hansen had recalled that it was like 95 or 100 degrees every day during filming, and they wouldn't wash his costume because they were worried that the laundry might lose it or that it would change color. So they didn't have enough money for a second costume. So we wore that mask for like 12 to 16 hours a day, 7 days a week for a month.
And you can totally see it on the actors' faces. Like you, like that first shot in the van, like I don't know how many times they shot that, but you can totally see it on everyone in that van that it is scorching. I mean, and that adds to the film for sure. That desolate, just oppressive heat. It really is like a secondary character in the film for sure. You can just feel the heat of that day. Like it's so hot. You can just feel it.
And most of the filming happened around that farmhouse. Like they had to keep it. You can tell how limited it is. And the house is, it's so unassuming because from the outside, it would look like it's some little old lady's house. You wouldn't be scared to walk up to that house and knock on the door from the outside. At least that's what I thought. But the other thing going on with the filming is that the special effects budget was obviously limited, and the on-screen blood in some cases was actually real. Apparently there was a scene where Leatherface feeds Grandpa, and the crew apparently had difficulty getting like stage blood to come out of its tube, so Burns index finger was cut with a razor, and Burns's costume was really drenched with stage blood, and that pretty much like sold the whole thing. So like she actually cut, they used the blood from her finger in this scene. It's so gross. I'm just like, okay, yeah, Grandpa, there you go. It's going to be. But there's also a scene where Leatherface decapitates Kirk with a chainsaw. Apparently it really scared the actor. And he was worried that he'd actually killed him. Something like that, because the chainsaw was running and it was like 3 inches from Bale's face. But there's so much good stuff going on. I just want to dig into a little bit more about the release of the film before we go through the plot. So the Texas Chainsaw Massacre premiered on October 1st, 1974. So happy anniversary to the film in Austin, Texas, and almost a year after the film like finished shooting. So it screened nationally in the United States as a Saturday afternoon matinee, and its false marketing as a true story helped it attract a really broad audience. And for about 8 years after the film came out, it was annually reissued to first run theaters and promoted by full page ads. So the film eventually grossed more than like $30 million in the United States and Canada. And I think it was like the 12th highest grossing film initially released in 1974, despite a very minuscule budget, which is kind of amazing. So
no, it's crazy.
It was eventually overtaken in 1978 by John Carpenter's Halloween, which only grossed $17 million more. So, but I do love Halloween. So, but Hooper reportedly hoped that the Motion Picture Association of America would give the complete uncut release print a PG-13 rating due to its minimal amount of visible gore. But instead, it was originally rated X. So after several minutes were cut, it was resubmitted and it finally received an R rating. And a distributor apparently restored the offending material. And at least one theater presented the full version under an R rating. So in San Francisco, cinemagoers walked out of the theater in disgust. And in February 1976, two theaters in Ottawa, Canada were advised by local police to withdraw the film or they would face morality charges. So I'm just like, whoa, okay. Like that's, I think it's just very cool that a film like this, when it, you think about news media violence and things like that, and this was before we started having a lot of those big conversations around violence in video games and like film and things like that. So it's sort of at the forefront of a lot of those conversations, it feels like. But even at this point in time, I think what the 1960s is when the PCA and like the Hays Code went away too. It really hadn't been that long that people would go to the theater and not see much of anything morally questionable. So it's just interesting to think about. But after its British release, including a 1-year theatrical run in London, the film was initially banned. Like, apparently there was a ban just with the word chainsaw altogether. They barred it from movie titles, and it forced any like imitators to rename their films as well. Because I think similar to Alien, how popular that was when it came out, a lot of films tried to bank on that popularity by including the word alien in their film titles.
Oh yeah, there's Nail Gun Massacre, and there's a bunch. That word massacre gets thrown around into lots of films like between 1974 and 1980.
I want to jump into the plot and really get all your thoughts on all the good juicy stuff. So the film opens with the eerie prelude that you talked about, including an introduction, a radio broadcast about several gruesome grave robbings. And Sally, her wheelchair-bound brother Franklin, Sally's boyfriend Jerry, her best friend Pam, and Pam's boyfriend Kirk are driving to an old homestead in Texas. So this is her grandfather's house. I don't recall that they ever make it to the cemetery to, like, check on his grave.
They, like, don't act. It's basically a police scene at the time. So, like, they've arrived and kind of, like, cleaned it up. And I've got the actual opening shot just on my computer right here, and it's just every time I look at it, it's just so disturbing.
I love this cemetery, the cuts to the cemetery that they do throughout that part of the film.
It's such, and I think the opening prelude too, it's, oh my gosh, just the position of the corpse and the head and cradled in the arms, and the lighting, the just everything about this shot is, it's so eerie, but it's also so, like, It's one of the best, like, it's just a beautifully composed, directed, and the cinematography. It's just it is like a perfect shot. It just happens to feature like the most disturbing imagery for a film of this era. I mean, going back to the idea that it was banned and things. I mean, it's weird because this film, even though every time I watch it, I've seen it so many times and I'm still disturbed every single time I watch it. And it just feels wrong watching this movie in so many parts. It's just like, I shouldn't be watching this. And yet, even though there's like a few moments, like pretty quick moments of violence, like a lot, it's not like comparatively to, like, you know, it's considered an exploitation film, and it's just not, it doesn't have that in a lot of places. It does not have that same, like, we're going to go over the top with the violence and, you know, nudity and gore to offend or shock or whatever. Like, it is a very, it picks its spots very brilliantly. Which is why I think it stands out in that whole sea of like 70s films. And while I love those films at the same time, I mean, I think that this film definitely, you know, there's a reason why it's preserved at the Museum of Modern Art and is revered in the way that it is, because, yeah, you just look at the opening shot, it's just gorgeous, just absolutely just a gorgeous, it looks like a painting. I mean, it's beautiful, even though it's disturbing and disgusting at the same time.
Yes, and it, like I said, it sets the whole tone. And I forget, they actually do stop at the cemetery so Sally can check on it, but like you said, it's like a crime scene at the time, so I don't remember that they actually go up to the grave or anything. But it, apparently she's just concerned it's been vandalized. So they pick up and, like, they get back in the car to go to the homestead.
Well, here's the thing. If they had arrived and they saw what was actually on the gravestone, you would think that they would just pack up and go home. Just let's go find a chill spot to smoke our weed and listen to some music. Like,
I feel like they were parked outside of the cemetery and they could kind of see into it being a crime scene, but yeah, they didn't go any further. So unfortunately for them, they get back in the car, they're on the road, they're just sweating profusely, you can see it on camera, and the Texas heat is really blazing during this time period. And they pick up this strange looking hitchhiker who's bumbling incoherently. And he takes a picture of the group, which I thought was really odd. And that was like my first, for someone from the time period that I have lived in. I found that to be scary and creepy the first time I watched the film. But he takes this picture and then he cuts himself with a razor and he cuts Franklin too. And so, yeah, it just escalates really quickly. And the group shoves the crazy man, as they call him, out of the van and drive off. And the hitchhiker smears blood all over the van as the group drives away. It's just like, that's probably one of the scariest things you could think. Maybe not the scariest, but like, imagine that happening to you as you're just like trying to drive down the highway. This is why you don't pick up creepy people off the highway. The hitcher hadn't come out yet, but
oh, this is like the hitchhiking era. This is like,
yeah,
this is like preying on that fear of like, watch out, you know, this represents so strongly that idea of be careful who you bring into your vehicle, and you know, not everybody that you pick up is going to be in the right mind and place.
Well, yeah, and this is another thing. I think if you think about it in true crime terms, during this time period, 1974 was Ted Bundy, right? And if you think of him not necessarily as a hitchhiker, but someone who is trying to get you to their car, there was a lot of this going on with the prolific serial killers during the time, all centered around either hitchhiking or solicitation and things like that. So I think this film was kind of hitting the mark before that became really big on the news. But the teenagers, they get to this gas station where the proprietor tells them that the tanks are empty. And so they set off to the house, but they're, I guess, it's like a plantation mansion or something. It's extremely run down and they run around in there like kids do, I guess. But tired of Pam and Kirk's annoying foreplay, apparently, is what it says. Franklin tells the couple about a nearby lake and the two set off. But instead, they find a house with a running generator. So Pam sits outside while Kirk explores inside the house. Upon entering a secret room, he comes, and this scene is just amazing. He comes face to face with a large man wearing a mask made out of human skin. And this is when we meet Leatherface for the first time. And the whole scene is just so terrifying, because Leatherface murders Kirk. He hits him in the head with a sledgehammer and drags him into the back room. And then Pam goes in the house where she like stumbles into this room filled with like bones and live chickens, and there's feathers everywhere. And she runs out of the house, but just as she gets out the front door, Leatherface catches her in this like bear hug from behind and picks her up off the ground. And from the front porch, he drags her back inside. He brings her down into the secret passageway or room and hangs her on a meat hook in the back room. And then she's forced to witness Leatherface dismembering Kirk with a chainsaw. And the part that really got me was when he, before he starts this activity of dismemberment, I think he runs back upstairs and shuts this like metal slider for the room. And that was really scary to me.
Yeah, it's that whole sequence is just easily one of the most, you know, I think the scariest sequences in any horror film ever shot. I mean, it's just unflinchingly disturbing and scary. And yeah, when he, just the appearance, the noises he makes, Gunnar Hansen's performance is just so unique. I mean, just again, like if I could just go back to 1974, like this is going back to the idea of this movie being the barometer, like this is the first real portrayal of any, you know, I don't necessarily, I know that this film is often considered like the prototypical slasher, like in the same vein as like kind of the evolution of what Psycho started. And it's interesting that, you know, both of those characters are modeled after Norman Bates and Leatherface being modeled after Ed Gein. This is it really is a prototypical slasher in the sense that it's got this hulking villain that uses power tools and each character is kind of like systematically killed off up to a final girl. Like it fits, it certainly fits the mold. However, I don't know. Regardless,
it's I think it's really unique though, because it came out at the same time that like Black Christmas came out, you know, in 1974.
Yeah, another film.
There was a lot of like
that mold
violence in the media that was influencing a lot of these things. So it was, it's so raw and it's so real. It feels like it's snatched right from the headlines. And that's why it's so believable as a potential true story, I think. And it is really terrifying. This is something that it's very simple actions by these characters, nothing really complex. And you can put yourself in the shoes of this could really happen to anyone. The only thing that seems outlandish is the character of Leatherface and maybe just how kind of maniacal and terrifying the family is.
Why do they keep going into the house? It's like, God.
I know. I was like, God, why? What is happening? And why is everyone just walking into this house like they own the place? It's so bad.
I wouldn't have even made it to the house. Like, just the generator and all the cars and just.
The cars are a giveaway now when you go now to, like, later films, like Wrong Turn, for example.
Yeah.
Like, no.
I would have 100%. Like, oh, that's just, it just drives me nuts when they're just stalling in the house with just statues made of bones. It's just like human bones. It's like, please get out of, what are you doing? Why are you?
Like, what do you think that is?
Yeah, it's
chandelier made of what? But this actually also is something that, I don't know that it really started that whole, it may not have started it, but it definitely plays into the hillbilly horror folklore trope. And except that it's very different because it's displaced. It's just like it's sort of in the country on a dusty, like nowhere road, which definitely gives you that backwoods feel, but it's not in the backwoods.
Yeah, well, it's like got that, it's the whole I think the hitchhiker's scene, the first scene at least, obviously he makes a dramatic reappearance later at the dinner, but that the whole I'm always fascinated every time I watch it. I'm so fascinated by everything that the hitchhiker says, because it is that the family, even though they're this like twisted, disturbing, cannibalistic, mass murdering family that does, yeah, without a doubt, kind of fit that trope, that, or at least begins the evolution of that trope. I mean, they're like a working class family that's dealing with kind of the evolution of technology and the whole thing about, like, you know, it's about the whole slaughterhouse, the idea of the slaughterhouse and how all of their jobs were wiped out because of the factory farming industry, basically, you know, that whole sequence about how he talks about how back in the day they used to use a sledgehammer. And then instead of the bolt to kill the cows, and then the first shot of Leatherface is him killing Kirk with a sledgehammer, and then ends with that perfect symmetry of Grandpa, the oldest member of the family. Ugh, like
Grandpa is just it's the scariest character me. It's wrinkly old Grandpa. I don't know how he's alive. I have no idea. And I don't, it almost feels like there's a myth, kind of a mystical or mythology thing there with like the blood and the way that, you know, they smear it into Grandpa's mouth. Cause I'm like, oh, like the blood, does the blood keeping him alive? Is that some other kind of like thing that is sort of outside of reality in a sense? It's, I don't know. It's such a creepy scene. But it was the one scene that kind of gave me a little more pause into like, oh, this is kind of interesting. Like, is that just something that is sort of like a sadistic sort of ritual? And that, again, will go into kind of the folklore type stuff with like Grandpa and all that. But evening does fall. And for whatever reason, they're still at this farmhouse. So Jerry goes to look for Kirk and Pam, and he finds the house. He goes inside again, and he enters the back room where he finds Pam locked in a freezer, barely alive. So apparently Pam freezes to death, but Leatherface appears and bashes Jerry in the head with a sledgehammer. And night comes soon after. Then Sally tries to push Franklin along the uneven forest trail in the darkness to find her friends because Franklin doesn't want to be left alone. And all of a sudden, Leatherface leaps out from the shadows and murders Franklin with a chainsaw. So Sally, this is where the screaming starts. Sally, she's fleeing through the dark woods and Leatherface is in hot pursuit, and she is just like endlessly chased through the woods by him wielding this chainsaw. And that's where we get a lot of the really scary chainsaw effects and scenes. It's like one of the very memorable scenes from the film. But until Sally finds the house where all of her friends have been killed at this point. So she races inside and upstairs, and she finds the remains of this elderly couple. And the man is barely alive and the woman is like dead and mummified. More creepy stuff. And then Sally gets attacked by Leatherface, and she actually leaps through an upstairs window to escape. So that's the first time that she escapes, and she runs through the woods until she gets back to the gas station. And inside, the proprietor is consoling her, and then he beats her with a broom. So he ties her up, shoves her in his truck, and he drives her back to the house. I remember, even though I knew what was going to happen, because I knew about the film before I had seen it for the first time, I was really hoping at this point that she was going to get away, but I knew that this guy was going to stop her.
Just the whole sequence with Drayton Sawyer's, just his face and
really sells it.
Oh, he's so good. He's so good. I mean, he's so different in this film than he is in the second, but as far as his character, like it's the character in the sequel is just like turned up to 11, but it is the first appearance, and then the second appearance is just very, very, when there's always a point in any good horror film where like a character that you believe to be sane, like there's a switch that flips, and when you realize as the audience, like pretty much simultaneously as she does, that Sally does, that this is not good. It's such a hard moment, because even though when you see she walks in there and there's the meat, it does not take much intellect to put together two and two. When as you're watching this for the first time, you're like, oh God, I know exactly what's happening. And so it builds up the tension and the suspense so strongly. And then you're just kind of waiting. And then it's like, there's a look in his eyes, and it's so, the acting is really strong. Like, I mean, there's a switch that flips, and then it's just downhill from there for poor Sally.
Yeah, poor Sally. She's tied up at the dinner table, and it's revealed that the hitchhiker, the proprietor of the gas station, Leatherface, they're all one big, happy, cannibalistic family. And Sally is like physically and verbally tormented at the dinner table by this demented family for what seems like hours. And she's almost killed when they try to get Grandpa, the barely alive man that Sally found earlier, to kill Sally with a sledgehammer, but he is too weak to do so. He can't even lift the thing. So infuriated, the hitchhiker grabs the hammer, letting go of Sally, and in all of the confusion, she actually breaks free and jumps through a window again outside, just as the sun has begun to rise. Windows are her preferred method of escape. So Sally runs to the road with Leatherface and the hitchhiker giving chase, but an 18-wheeler drives by and actually hits the hitchhiker and kills him. And he just stops dead right there, because initially Sally's like trying to jump into the big truck, like the semi truck, but she actually jumps into a pickup truck instead, and Leatherface tries to saw at the door, and I think they climb out of the other side, and Leatherface pursues them, and the truck driver hits Leatherface in the head with a wrench, causing him to drop his chainsaw and cut his leg. And then Sally jumps into the back of the truck. She's driven away, and she's just like laughing hysterically in the back of the truck as Leatherface goes into a little tantrum and swings his chainsaw in frustration all over the street. In some of his, I love Leatherface's outfit at the end of the film. Personally, he's just like all done up, like he's going to a fancy dinner.
Oh yeah, he serves the meal. Yeah,
he serves the meal. but this is this moment when Sally escapes is a really iconic scene for everybody. And this is where we get, you know, Sally as a final girl character. So in terms of the critical response for the film, it got a really mixed reaction when it was initially released. Linda Gross of the Los Angeles Times called it despicable and described Henkel and Hooper as more concerned with creating a realistic atmosphere than with its like plastic script. Roger Ebert, of course, he hates horror movies, or he hated horror movies. So, he was at the Chicago Sun-Times at the time and said that it was as violent and gruesome and blood-soaked as the title promises. Yet he actually praised the acting and technical execution of the film. So getting even a little nod is good. Patrick Taggart of the Austin American Statesman hailed it as the most important horror film since George A. Romero's Night of the Living Dead in 1968. I would agree with that for the time period when it came out.
For sure.
Variety had said that the picture was well made despite what it called the heavy doses of gore. And John McCarty of Cinefantastic stated that the house featured in the film made the Bates Motel look positively pleasant by comparison. So revisiting the film in his 1976 article, Fashions in Pornography for Harper's Magazine, Stephen Koch found its sadistic violence to be extreme and unimaginative. Pam, even when Pam gets put on that meat hook, there's no blood. You don't even see it enter her body.
Yeah, it's like there's so much implied violence.
I think for a gory film, it's really toned down. Yeah, it's very similar to, if you're going to compare it to Psycho, for example, that whole shower scene is people remember, oh, the knife going into Janet Leigh's skin and all this gore and stuff. But it's, you don't actually see any of that. It's all implied. So but it's really scary because what we can imagine is much scarier than what we could see with the naked eye. Right. But critics later frequently praise both the film's aesthetic quality and its power, observing that it managed to be horrifying without being a bloodbath. And you'll see more gore in a Steven Seagal film is what one person had said. And Bruce Westbrook of the Houston Chronicle had called it a backwoods masterpiece of fear and loathing. And TV Guide thought it was intelligent in its bloodless depiction of violence. So, I mean, it's interesting. Like, over time, it did get a lot of praise, and it's definitely a cult classic for everyone now. And reminiscing about his first viewing of the film, horror director Wes Craven had actually recalled wondering what kind of Masonite crazoid could have created such a thing. And it is this work of cataclysmic terror. That's what Stephen King had said about it. And I don't know. It's just like, it's one of those things that whenever someone is going to recommend a horror film or, you know, they'll talk about slashers. I think you can't recommend horror to someone without talking about the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah. And even like going back to the Wes Craven, Last House on the Left, he directed that and put that film together like a couple years before this one, but I know that Craven has gone on record or went on record talking about Hooper's influence and this specific film directly led to him creating The Hills Have Eyes. So The Hills Have Eyes, you know, just the path to get from this film out of the kind of the exploitation films of that era of the exploitation horror films. It's just a landmark film. So yeah, unbelievably influential and important. And certainly in the Mount Rushmore of horror films, like a modern American horror films for sure.
Yes, that's a great depiction of it, because it has a huge cultural impact. It's considered to be one of the greatest and most controversial horror films, and it's just a major influence on the entire genre. And I think actually in 1999, Richard Zoglin of The Time, he commented that it had set a new standard for slasher films. And at the time, it's funny because I can't really even think of slasher films prior to like the early 1970s when this came out. Whenever I think, to me, in my mind, the first slasher film is Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah, it definitely doesn't fit the genre as much, but it's, I feel like it's kind of the, when any genre is forming, it's like in that early, before the genre actually has its conventions or actually has like the established rules. It definitely doesn't like fit all the rules, but it's like, I don't think we would get Halloween, or I don't think we would get, you know, those like modern, the like first couple of slasher films without Psycho, you know? So it's like, we had to have Psycho in order to get Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Oh, definitely.
But yeah, I think Texas Chainsaw Massacre is that first, like, here are some teenagers in a van that are going to try to like smoke, you know, weed and find a swimming hole to go have sex. And they're going to get like brutally massacred and taken out one by one.
Yeah.
And then you're
left. I feel like it was very revolutionary for its time, or at least it started a slasher revolution in a sense.
Yeah.
Or just what do I want to say? Sort of cemented the genre, even though it probably didn't get the credit for it until much later.
Yeah, for sure.
But Leatherface as a character has gained a big reputation and a lot of significance in the horror genre, and is responsible for establishing the use of conventional tools as murder weapons and the image of a large silent killer devoid of personality. Now, it's interesting that I found that quote, because to me, Leatherface has an immense personality, a really big personality.
Gunnar Hansen's performance is like, I mean, easily on par with any other like famous character behind a mask, whether it's Kane Hodder or Nick Castle or whatever,
right.
Whoever has played, obviously Robert Englund, like whatever, any famous slasher, like Gunnar Hansen is easily part of that crew.
Yes. And I would say, while Leatherface is not my favorite of the classic killers, and often people don't even think about Leatherface, they think about Jason, Freddy, and Michael, right?
Yeah, right. That's
that
the Trinity.
Performance of Gunnar Hansen, Leatherface is by far the scariest of them all, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I mean, like, there's other slasher villains or antagonists that are silent, but yeah, there is something very, it's the thing is, he's not silent because the portrayal, there's something very somber and kind of depressing about Gunnar Hansen's character. Just everything to Hooper's direction, the character itself, like there is something very melancholy about and sad. So it's weird because you like,
that's why I get that sense of him being a very misunderstood character.
Yeah. Yeah. You sense that by the end of the film, especially like, I think with the ending of the chainsaw dance, it's like, that's when
I love that scene.
Oh, it's amazing.
The chainsaw dance is absolutely fantastic.
Yeah. And you really get it by then. I mean, you already got it before that, but there's I can't remember exactly in the placement in the film, but there's like a really it's like a slow zoom out, and it's like a long shot of Leatherface's face, and you can kind of see like the lips and the mouth beneath the mask, and it just kind of like slowly pulls back. And it's a long shot. It's like at least 10 seconds. It might be longer than that. And yeah, it's you get so much of the character, and because they're silent in the context of like the hitchhiker and the cook, like you see the family dynamics and it becomes very clear, like kind of that the character is kind of tragic. And so even though they're doing horrible things, you can't help but like feel that weird, like that weird sense of like, what you want to know more about the character. I think that's when you finished, maybe, you know, I said earlier,
silently like, fascinating, but yeah, he's not really silent, but yeah, he doesn't speak any audible words. So, yeah.
Well, I think that's why the character lives on, I guess, because that makes sense, because you end the film and you want to know more about that specific character.
We're going to go to Rotten Tomatoes, our favorite place. But thanks to a smart script and documentary-style camera work, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre achieves start-to-finish suspense, making it a classic in low-budget exploitation cinema. And the critics and audience score is pretty close. What do you think it is?
Gosh, it's so hard to tell with like films of this era. I mean, I know films like a film like Alien is going to be pretty close to 100. I would say that this one probably sits lower than that. I would probably say somewhere between, I mean, it's got to be over 50, right? 50, 58?
Oh, this is 89%. Oh,
okay. Well, that's much.
89 and 82. So tomato meter for the critics is 89% certified fresh. And the audience score is an 82.
That's really good for a horror film.
Yeah. Now, this is, I think it's aggregated based on every critic's review of all time. So it's based on how the film sits now at this point in time, which I think that's pretty great.
Oh, yeah. I'm so glad that this film was able to escape the, just like John Carpenter's The Thing, it was able to get out of that funk of the critical lens of the time. I mean, I know that, yeah, like people did see the brilliance in it, but yeah, this movie really is on a different level than most, any film of any genre. I mean, it's.
Well, kill count wise, only 5 people died in this film. There were other dead bodies, but not that we saw get murdered. So the kill count includes Kirk. Obviously, we know they got bludgeoned in the head with a sledgehammer. Pam, who was impaled on the meat hook, but later froze to death in the freezer. Jerry, who was bludgeoned to death in the head with a sledgehammer also, because it doesn't count if you don't do it twice. Franklin, who was sawed in the chest and stomach with a chainsaw. And of course, the hitchhiker, or also known as, I don't know if it's played by this person, but they mentioned... Nubbins Sawyer is the name, accidentally run over by the big semi truck. So, you know, in terms of who Leatherface killed, there were only 4 at that moment in time. Obviously, there were way more. I think in the entire franchise, there's over 85 deaths.
Yeah, they really pick up eventually, but.
Yeah, they do pick up over time. But when compared to other popular horror film series, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre is actually the 8th highest grossing horror franchise in the United States. Let's rate the film. Bloody knives. You finally get some. Here you go. You've got 5 bloody knives to rate it with. But before we do, actually, let me ask you who your favorite character is.
Okay, so I'm not going to say Franklin, but I...
Oh my God, I was going to say, I hate Franklin, but he's kind of my favorite character.
I think that, look, I'm not going to lie, like, when I first, the first time I saw his film, I think I was 13, and I absolutely loathed Franklin for a long time, but I think as I've gotten older, I think that I think that Franklin is, like, I understand Franklin, like, I get, like, he is... Like, it sucks for Franklin, that whole situation. And Franklin's just an interesting character. He's just kind of a dork that, like, is interested in history and facts, and he's smart. And
I feel like I am Franklin.
Yeah, me too. So. I identify,
with Franklin.
Yes, the older I get, the more I identify with Franklin, and the more so I would say that, even though I'm not going to say that outright, Franklin is my favorite character, but my favorite character is the truck driver, for sure.
The truck driver?
Oh, yeah.
The truck driver in the pickup truck or the one that runs over rig. Nubbins?
No, the big rig, the one that runs over Nubbins.
Because you just love his face at that moment when he hits him with the truck. It's so good.
Just because, like, that person was just driving their big rig and down a long stretch of desolate highway, and just you can just see they're only on screen for like 45 seconds, and yet they maximize that look of just like, I'm getting the fuck out of here. It is like so perfect. But
that to be the what the fuck moment of the film is like so fun.
It's because it's just a perfect reaction. It's just like, oh, I'm getting back in my car, like I'm getting out of here.
Like, I could easily give this 5 out of 5 bloody knives. I gave it 4 out of 5 bloody knives instead.
Yeah, I will do the I don't want to say cliche, but I'll
it's give a classic.
I can't justify myself not giving it a 5. I mean, it really is a film that I think I notice. It's one of those films that I notice something new every time I watch it. Again, it's not a comfort film for me. Like, I don't like sit and watch it the way
not for me either. Like, Halloween is one of my core comfort films where I could turn it on if I'm having like a bad day. Like, it will lull me to sleep. Like, not that I'm not interested in it, but it just has that effect on me because it's 100%. Comforting.
Yeah, like a lot of Carpenter has that effect for me, and there's plenty of others, but I really like, I love this film in the sense that I believe it's a brilliant, I see its brilliance. I think Tobe Hooper is like, transcends horror, even though he doesn't transcend horror, like in the conversation of like the best directors of all time, like they should.
Yeah. I don't think we talk about Tobe Hooper enough. And like, I think he should be up there with how we talk about the Wes Cravens and the John Carpenters and.
Oh, I would all put. I mean, like, I think Tobe Hooper should be in the conversation with, like, you know, the like the Hitchcocks and the Scorseses and the like. I think Tobe Hooper is like a brilliant filmmaker that does not completely transcends the genre. And even though they're known for their genre works, I think that it's only a matter of time before there's kind of like a revisionist. Everything that has happened with this film, as far as like critics going back and realizing like how brilliant it is, I think that the same thing will happen with Tobe Hooper's other films. And there's a lot of critics that are already kind of like trying to make this happen. I mean, like Mike Thorne, a great author, has written like literary film criticism, kind of attempting to do this. Scout Tafoya has a book called that came out this year. That's really good. Highly recommend it. It's called Cinemophagy, and it breaks down every single film by Tobe Hooper. Obviously, there's a long section on this film specifically, but really does that work of like, you know, like when Poltergeist was released, people that film was made by Tobe Hooper, and yet when it was being made, like everyone tried to say that it was a Steven Spielberg film. Like Spielberg became like known as like the, like people accused Steven Spielberg of directing the film and giving the shadow credit to Tobe Hooper, which is complete and total BS. So it's like, I hope that this process happens with Tobe Hooper, because I think that Texas Chainsaw Massacre, considering everything, considering its place in time, its place in history, its innovations, it absolutely is one of the most important films in cinematic history, not just in horror, in actual film. So it's brilliant. 5 out of 5 bloody knives.
Definitely. Well, Donnie, thanks for coming and talking about the film. Happy spooky season and happy anniversary to the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Happy anniversary indeed.
Thanks for gathering around the campfire, listeners. Come slay away with us next time and be sure to follow on Twitter and Facebook.
Hey Slayers, did you enjoy that episode? If you like the podcast, we encourage you to head over to Podchaser and leave us a review. The best part is it helps put Slayaway in the hands of more horror fans.